Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, more than 7,000 people sign a petition seeking to remove a Utah school board member for her online comments about LGBTQ students and Black Lives Matter. A new bill at the legislature seeks to prevent transgender girls from participating in female sports in Utah schools. Utah says it will begin vaccinating those 65 years of age and older beginning March 1st, and a comment during a legislative committee meeting triggers alarm bells for opponents of the Utah Inland Port. On the phone for this discussion, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Good morning, Taylor. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Reporter Courtney Tanner is also with us. Welcome to you, Courtney. Thanks as well.
Thanks, Roger.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Hey, Robert, thank you to you also.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Roger.
Listeners, your questions and comments, you can join with them by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We've had a kind of relentless news cycle, and it's spanning a lot of different topics, and we've got a lot to cover today. Let's start with this petition to remove a state school board member. And Courtney Tanner, state school board member Natalie Klein, I sort of pointed at this in my introduction, but why the movement afoot to try to get her removed from the school board?
Yeah, that's it's been an interesting week, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So there was this petition that's been circling to have Natalie Klein removed from her school board position based on some comments that she had made on social media. So parents and teachers have essentially said that, you know, her comments were homophobic and racist. And, that's what kind of drew this.
She is a recent addition to the state school board because she was elected in basically the first partisan elections that the state has seen for school board. Where did the partisan election part of this come from? Was that a legislative rule?
Yeah, Gerke could probably explain it a little better, but there was kind of a big battle over it, and the Utah Supreme Court essentially decided that this could go forward, essentially, so that there could be partisan school board races. This fall is the first time that it happened, so Natalie Klein ran as a Republican.
I'm going to hold off on Gerke for just a minute, and I will have him comment, but you mentioned these online comments. I guess what did Natalie Klein say that drew so much ire?
Yeah, the kind of the bulk of maybe the concern was her comments on the LGBT community. And this is stuff I should point out that, you know, she did say when she was running for office, you know, within the debates and on her campaign website. But recently she kind of went after this convention that the Utah Pride Center had. It was a convention for teachers to go to and kind of learn how to create a welcoming environment for LGBT students. And Natalie Klein wrote, quote, "They are after your children's hearts and minds. This presentation will make you soul sick." And then she also, you know, called it indoctrinating your children with LGBT ideology. I think that's probably the bulk of where people are concerned. You know, she called LGBT kids gender confused. So she also made some comments about teaching about race theory, saying that the purpose of that is to tell white children that they're all racist, again, calling Black Lives Matter indoctrination. So her comments kind of run the gamut.
Okay. Before we go to Gerke again, Robert Gerke, the news columnist, Courtney, this petition, though, you know, it's got some 7,500 signatures, maybe more than that now. I haven't looked. But you point out in your article that it sends a message, the school board, though, in a kind of rare statement, threw some cold water on the petition. Explain that, if you would.
Yeah, the school board very rarely does a statement, so it was actually kind of interesting. It's a 15-member body, so usually they just kind of let members speak for themselves. But the leadership of the board put out this statement that essentially says that they can't remove Klein. Even though this petition is calling for that, they have no authority to do that. Klein is an elected official with the state. So the only way to essentially remove her from her position is like a formal impeachment process. So the state board says, you know, that's beyond our reach. What they could do is remove her from committee assignments or censor her. They had a board meeting yesterday. They chose not to do any of those things. But yeah.
Okay. Robert Gerke, news columnist, you wrote about this. You called this the school board's Marjorie Taylor Greene problem. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Sure. Marjorie Taylor Greene is the congresswoman who was removed from her committees yesterday because of comments she made about conspiracy theories and QAnon and so forth. And the reason I think it's an apt comparison, or maybe a smaller scale, obviously, is that, you know, these are comments that are, you know, it's what she thinks, but it's also dangerous to the, you know, the job she's supposed to be doing. So, you know, as Courtney mentioned, the board opted to, you know, there was a pretty profound and moving statement by one of the board members at the beginning of the meeting yesterday, but the board didn't take any official action. Which I think is a little unfortunate. I mean, I think if nothing else, they could have voted to reiterate their views that they previously expressed, opposing racism and supporting, you know, diversity and inclusion, and expanded on it perhaps to, you know, to just really emphasize that, you know, this is the part of the school system is making, you know, part of the importance of the school system, and one of the critical the necessities of the school system is to make a welcoming place where people feel like they can go there to learn. So, you know, I think it's an unfortunate thing. I kind of am inclined to agree that, you know, removing her from office was not really a viable option, if it was an option at all legally. So, you know, but this is also, and Courtney can speak to this, I mean, this is not the first time we've had board members who have fairly fringy ideas about the way the school should operate. And you know, I think...
Robert, what's the role of the fact that partisan elections are happening now for school board in that kind of... what you're describing as fringe ideas, you know, coming in.
Well, I mean, it's hard to know, really. I mean, Natalie ran not unopposed, but she still wasn't a Democratic opponent. She ran against an independent who she beat. I think she got almost 70%. I think it was between two-thirds and 70% of the vote against an independent member. She represents a conservative part of the state, a conservative district on the board.
Right.
So it's not necessarily surprising that you have somebody who, you know, espouses these views. She was pretty upfront during the campaign, touting her activism for these, you know, ultra-conservative causes, including, you know, working on behalf of one group that, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, is a hate group because of its anti-LGBTQ views. You know, so it may not be because of these partisan races, but it also very well could be, right? I mean, the Republican Party wanted to make these partisan races, so voters go into the voting booth and don't necessarily, you know, do their homework on the school board races that are way at the bottom of their ticket. So, you know, they give them this signal: this is a Republican, this is a Democrat. You know, pick your party more than pick the person. And it's also, you know, the concern is that it creates a sense of partisanship in what had always been, at least ostensibly, a nonpartisan body. So, you know, it's hard to say that she wouldn't have been elected if she wasn't a Republican, because she won the Republican nomination. She, again, ran almost unopposed. I mean, again, there was an independent. But, you know, so it's sort of hard to point the finger, I think, at school board, or at partisan school board races, although, you know, it certainly creates an opportunity in other districts that might, you know, might, where voters might make the decision based on the views of the candidates, to sort of fall back on this crutch of partisanship.
I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by tweeting to @KCPW or calling 801-355-8255. And I'll go back to Courtney Tanner here. Courtney, you know, just before we move on to other stories, you wrote that Natalie Klein does have some support. I mean, obviously, she has some support because she was elected to the district that she's in. But there are some who are also rallying to her cause, correct?
Yeah, and that's actually really important to point out. She did win by 38 percentage points, which, you know, is no small feat. And, yeah, there were quite a number of people who were kind of pushing back. So those who signed the petition to remove her had kind of flooded her social media with comments kind of criticizing her. And then Natalie Klein's supporters kind of joined in and did the opposite. So it was this kind of war of social media comments and a flood of letters to the state school board. But she definitely does have supporters who agree with her and who say, you know, parental rights are kind of the top tier for education. Parents should be in charge of telling their student or their kids what to learn. Two women did speak. Two mothers spoke at the State Board of Education yesterday during the public comment period supporting her. So, yeah, she definitely isn't alone, I guess.
You know, Courtney, the sort of remedy that those who don't, you know, who are unhappy with her views and statements have in front of them, as you pointed out, you know, the petition can't really amount to much, is an election. She was just elected this last November. How long is her term?
Yeah, so she stepped into the position in January, and she will be in it for 4 years.
Okay, great. We're going to have to move on to other stories here because we've got a lot to cover, as I said at the top of the show. And so, Courtney Tanner, I will just say thank you for covering this for us. A myriad of places we could go next. Let's bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. You know, before we jump into the legislature, something else that you covered in the past couple of days, not related to this year's meeting of lawmakers, Taylor, vaccines. Utah will soon be expanding who is able to get a vaccine. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Lieutenant, now Governor Spencer Cox, made this announcement yesterday that starting March 1st, the vaccinations will open to people 65 and older, as well as to people with some severe and chronic health conditions. And currently, we are vaccinating people 70 and older, as well as healthcare officials and teachers. And so that will really open up the number of people who are eligible to receive a vaccine and open up some really vulnerable groups to the coronavirus.
Those vulnerable groups, you mentioned certain chronic health conditions. What kinds of health problems are we talking about, and how big of a group is that in the state of Utah?
Yeah, so some of and this is not a comprehensive list, and for that I'd encourage people to go to the Utah Department of Health's website, or we have this in our story at sltrib.com, but in the list is people who are immunocompromised or have a weakened immune system from blood, bone marrow, or organ transplants, people with certain cancers, people who have been the recipients of solid organ transplants, people with severe obesity, chronic liver disease, chronic heart disease, just to name a few. And I believe that the governor said that's about 400,000 Utahns, and that will kind of help the state once the next influx of vaccinations come in, make sure that there are people in line to receive those, so those vaccines are being used up each week as they're being received.
Okay. I'm just going to go to Robert Gerke, the news columnist here. And Gerke, you know, are we getting somewhere with all of this? We're marching towards the end of the pandemic, it feels like, if we can just get everybody vaccinated. Still some waiting to do, though.
Yeah, there's going to be waiting to do. I mean, that was kind of, I think everybody recognized that it's going to take time to vaccinate 320 plus million Americans, right? So, but it's encouraging. They're ramping up production, they're ramping up shipments, requiring more doses. And it's important that we get as many people vaccinated as we can, because we don't really know what's going to happen with these mutant strains, these variants that are potentially, according to some of the reports that we're seeing now, you know, very, very viral, very, you know, contagious and very deadly. So I think it's, you know, we're on a good trajectory, maybe going faster than I anticipated, but we've got to keep the foot on the gas, I think. And I think one of the important things that the governor emphasized yesterday was that people are going to need to be patient a little bit, that when we're vaccinating, you know, potentially millions of new times, you know, there's going to be hiccups, there's going to be waits, there's going to be mistakes made. And so, you know, he wants people to understand that and be patient and you know, but also, you know, get behind as soon as they're eligible to. You know, and this is, I guess, encouraging that by March, April, and May, we're going to have hundreds and thousands of doses going into people's arms, and that's really going to hopefully bring down the trajectory on this virus.
Okay. I'm going to quickly side plug a conversation that I had yesterday for the KCPW program In the Hive with Dr. Stephen Goldstein, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Utah, and who talked about virus evolution and those variants that we've all been hearing about. I just want to point out that experts say the vaccines do work in boosting your immune response against those variants. They might not entirely prevent you from getting sick if you catch one of those variants, but the immune response will largely keep people out of the hospital and alive, and that is good news. We are up against a break here in the show, and so we are going to head to our first break, and there's still more to come, including some bills or some of the bills that are drawing attention at this year's meeting of state lawmakers. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Courtney Tanner, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, the legislature is now in full swing. It's kind of an unusual session. Some lawmakers have had to leave because of COVID. At first, a great deal was done remotely. Now there is some in-person public participation. Let's get to some specific bills from this session. And one that you covered this week has to do with transgender students and sports. What's it about and where is it coming from?
Yeah, so this bill is sponsored by Representative Kira Berkland, and what it would do is it would require all schools as well as colleges to categorize their athletic activities as either male, female, or co-ed. And students who are defined as, you know, being of the male sex, quote-unquote, would not be to participate in sporting events designated as being for women. And the bill sort of also opens the door for legal action against schools that don't comply. So any student who feels that they've lost an athletic opportunity or has been harmed by a violation of this state law could sue for damages under the bill.
I'm going to ask you a question that I often hear lawmakers ask, though I didn't necessarily hear it around this bill. The question is, what problem is this legislation trying to fix? Can you address that, Taylor? I mean, what does the sponsor of the bill say is there a current issue with this in the state of Utah?
Yeah, Representative Berkland is the junior varsity basketball coach for the girls team at Morgan High School. And she sees and feels that there is a lack of fairness and equality with women's sports. And she said that she's spoken to some, you know, female athletes who are concerned that they are competing against people who are, you know, physically at an advantage and that they can't overcome that physical advantage. And so she says, you know, we've got to address this issue, and this is about equity for women's sports. However, you know, members of the LGBTQ community and advocates say that this bill is, you know, targeting young people who are already vulnerable, who are already at a higher risk of suicide, and that this bill, you know, wouldn't really make a big difference because most kids who play sports just want to have fun with their friends, and they're not really at that elite level, regardless of gender identity.
I noticed that there is a national conversation on this front as well. Senators Lee and Romney in favor of a version of this same proposal, I guess, in the U.S. Senate. Is that correct, Taylor?
Yeah, Senator Mitt Romney spoke about this earlier this week, and he also agrees. He says that, you know, he spoke about his grandchildren and argues that they shouldn't be competing with people that are in a different category physiologically. So this is also happening on a national level. Additionally, we've seen these proposals come up in other states. Idaho is the only state that so far has approved one of these sports bills, but they are popping up in states around the country similarly to this proposal in Utah.
Can I ask actually why that's the case, like why there is a national conversation on this front at this particular moment? Do you know what I mean? Like, why is this popping up at the national level and is a point of focus in state legislatures?
At least in the state level, there's a conservative legal advocacy group that is pushing these bills in different states. It's called the Alliance Defending Freedom. But one LGBTQ advocate that we spoke with from Equality Utah says that he calls this kind of thing tabloid legislation because it stirs up emotions, ignites culture wars. So, you know, there are some people who feel this is a genuine issue that needs to be addressed. But, you know, there's another hand of folks who just sort of see this as a way to stir up controversy and, you know, have this conversation, maybe prove your conservative bona fides.
And a way, according to advocates, to, you know, to further stigmatize people. Robert Gerke, how do you see what this this legislation is about from a freshman representative?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Taylor hit on the logical questions to ask, and that is, what problem are we solving? And I don't think anybody can point to a problem in Utah that this is resolving. And so when that happens, when you start legislating, especially on social and cultural matters, and there's not an underlying issue that you're resolving, it's purely for show. It's a stage act, and it's throwing, you know, gasoline on a pretty you know, pretty hot issue. And it's unfortunate that you start making children pawns for politicians to score political points, especially, you know, at a time when we've really tried to step up our efforts to be, as we talked about earlier, inclusive in our schools and with, you know, LGBTQ students. And there's also, I think, sort of another piece of this. This is not the only bill that's targeting trans students. I mean, there's a bill to prohibit doctors from, you know, administering hormone blockers and starting the process for transitioning for minors. You know, and they're, you know, they're, I guess maybe it's the new group that that conservatives feel like they can single out and discriminate against. But it's unfair, and it's I think it's really bad policy, and it's, you know, kind of cynical, I think, to try to be for political grandstanding purposes.
Got it. I will. Let's see here. What's happening with this bill, Taylor Stevens? Where are we in terms of where this bill is headed?
Yeah, this bill has yet to receive a committee hearing. The language was just released this week. And so we'll see this next go to a House committee and sort of see where it goes from there. Obviously, a bunch more legislative sort of measures to hit before this would become law, but we'll see where it goes.
Okay. All right. Well, I have the sneaking suspicion that we will not get to everything that we have set out to cover today on this show, but let's press on. Taylor, budgetary doings are sometimes harder to follow on up at the legislature than individual bills are. And in a budget meeting this week, somebody said something that was, you know, kind of worrisome to those who are playing watchdog to the Utah Inland Port. This has to do with a trans loading facility or a proposed truck-to-rail facility on Salt Lake City's west side. What was the worrisome thing that was said, according to those, you know, Inland Port opponents?
Yeah, so this happened last week at a budget hearing, as you said, and the State Institute, Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, SITLA, the director spoke to a legislative committee and mentioned some upcoming legislation he anticipated that would help the company clean up an old landfill in the Inland Port area so that they could build a second rail pipeline through the Inland Port area. And so this is something that, you know, opponents of this project have really been worried about. They see this as kind of supersizing a project. They're already worried about emissions. And so this really was concerning to them when they heard this. However, you know, things got a little bit more complicated once we tried to find out what was actually going on.
And well, so why did it get more complicated when you tried to find out what was actually going on?
Well, I called Sitla just, you know, to follow up and see if we could get any more details about these plans and when they might go into place. And I spoke with someone, you know, different than who had spoken in the meeting. And he said that they're not sure what's going to be built on that land and said that any additional questions should go to the Port Authority itself. And so, you know, this sort of was presented as a very serious proposal or even a sure thing in the committee hearing, and then Sitla sort of backed off of that. So, you know, calling the Inland Port and trying to get more details from them, they were directing us back to Sitla and saying that they're not pushing any legislation around the creation of a second rail line and that they didn't know what Sitla was talking about. So at this point, it's a little bit hard to know how serious this proposal is, whether there really is a legislative appropriations request coming for something like this. We just don't know at this point.
And you just have to wait and try and keep tabs on whether or not that funding request comes through. Taylor, how, just out of curiosity, how do you do that?
So we'll be just tracking any bills that come up. So far, there's only been one bill filed in relation to the Inland Port from Representative Francis Gibson. I tried to get in touch with him this week and wasn't able to, but we hear from port leaders that that doesn't have anything to do with this, that this is sort of a vehicle for some separate funding requests that the Port Authority has. But we'll just be trying to keep an eye on any bills that are filed in relation to the Inland Port, and also just checking up on agendas and seeing if there are, you know, anything related to the Inland Port we'll be trying to keep tabs on. But that's really what we know right now.
All right. Robert Gerke, news columnist, some, you know, kind of opaque or hard to follow doings at the legislature, money to fund the cleanup of this site, you know, for maybe a truck to rail facility that is potentially in the offing. Is this the Inland Port ramping up, or is it just we don't know yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it. That's the big question. I mean, if memory serves, and Taylor can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the state took over this landfill and I guess in the process apparently took over an obligation to clean it up. And it does, you know, I can understand why opponents of the port are concerned about this. I mean, it does, A, it's taxpayer money being used to, you know, on this project, but also it creates a opportunity or a window to have a larger port operation, and they don't like the one that's already slated. So, you know, it's this constant push and pull, I think, and I'm glad Taylor's on top of it, and I think we'll probably learn more about it in the coming weeks. But you also touched on the other thing, the opaque nature of this. I mean, this is not a transparent process by any means, and I think the Port Authority should have learned their lesson from, you know, being opaque in the past, and it needs to step up and let people know what they're doing and be upfront about it if they want to engender trust in the project. Hmm.
Speaking of opaque and authorities, my underplayed story, which we're going to get to sooner than later, has to do with a measure to create the Colorado River Authority of Utah, and a part of the bill creation is that its doings, you know, will be exempt from the Open and Public Meetings Act. And maybe we'll come to that at the end of the show. But for the moment, I think let's take another break in the show. And there's still more to come here on Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Heard every Friday morning live on these airwaves. Join us with your questions and comments again at KCPW to tweet to us, or you can call 801-355-8255. We've actually got a comment from a listener that we will come to about a story that we've already covered when we return. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Courtney Tanner, and Robert Gerke. And you can join us to offer your comments or pose a question by calling 801-355-8255. I mentioned a comment. I'll come back to that because I can't find it at this exact moment. But Taylor Stevens, a lot of stories to get to still. And I want to turn to homelessness now. A couple of weeks ago, you and I talked about Camp Last Hope, a different kind of homeless encampment. People this week were dispersing from this camp. They were leaving ahead of a planned action by the county health department. Actually, before we get to that action, just remind us again, what is, or I guess what was, Camp Last Hope?
Yeah, Camp Last Hope was a very organized encampment that popped up in kind of this industrial area in Salt Lake City near 9th South and 5th West under an overpass. And the organizers there were helping provide donations and medical treatment and food, all kinds of resources there on site. We spoke with a lot of people who were really doing well at that encampment and felt very stable there. It popped up on December 11th and officially closed on Thursday with a health department, quote-unquote, cleanup that they do. And so, you know, Camp Last Hope is no more. It has dispersed to some smaller camps throughout the city. Some of those folks have gone into shelter or detox, other resources. But that camp, which is one of the biggest that Salt Lake City has seen in recent years, is no more.
And it sort of self-dispersed, as you said, ahead of this action. The health department was, the county health department, that is, was going to go in and clean up. What happens in these cleanups, and has that now happened?
Yeah, so there were a few people left on site on Thursday morning when the health department came in. And so what you see in a lot of these cleanups is sometimes items have been abandoned or people can't carry all of the items that they have. And the health department comes in and throws away items that can't be taken that are left over. And they also, you know, in some cases, and I'm not saying this is the case at Camp Last Hope because they've had some needle exchange, but in some cases they have to clean up, human waste as well as needles and just some of the health and environmental risks that can come with camp and encampment cleanups. That's usually what we see here. The organizers of Camp Last Hope did want this largely to be cleaned up by volunteers. Their goal was to have everyone out and all the garbage cleaned up, everything cleaned up by the time the health department came. As I said, that didn't exactly work out. There were a few people left over, but the camp had really dissolved to a smaller size by that point.
And is it, is it gone and will return, or is it gone for good, Taylor, or do we know?
It's hard to know. One thing that Salt Lake City has been doing recently with camp cleanups is trying to permanently close some spaces to camping. I'm not sure if they've done that here, but we do know that the camps, you know, the people who were staying there have dispersed to some smaller camps located throughout the city. So whether that will come back, I think, is still to be seen.
And those involved in providing official homelessness services in the region, some of them, as you and I discussed, were worried that this was keeping people out of that official system. Is that, I guess I wonder if that's part of the driving factor behind the cleanup. I'm certain that would probably not be the stated reason for the cleanup.
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons that the health department conducts cleanups, one of them being complaints. And so they have received complaints from businesses as well as from the property owner, Union Pacific, which wanted to see this cleaned up and thought that it was a health hazard to have them here kind of nestled between the railroad tracks. So that was certainly one element of this. Just going back to your comments about, you know, the sort of forces, whether they're working together as far as the official system and kind of this unofficial system, these organizers of this camp are now working in conjunction with the city. Mayor Aaron Mendenhall actually gave this camp a little bit more time after some consultation with the leaders of this camp. So they are working together, which has caused some, you know, consternation in the Salt Lake City activist community between some folks who don't want to work within the official system and some other folks who are a little bit more reform-minded. So it's been interesting to see some of those conflicts popping up. But, yeah, we're seeing that, you know, there are a lot of people involved in this homeless space as far as volunteers and community members who are trying to get involved right now. And so it's a really interesting dynamic shift in the way people are working on this issue.
I want to actually, before we bring in another voice on this, Taylor, I want to tackle a related story that you wrote about this week. And that is that a Salt Lake City resident and advocate has invited a number of people who are experiencing homelessness to camp on his property in the yard of his house, right?
Yeah, that's right. He lives in Salt Lake City's Fair Park neighborhood. He's had over the last few weeks anywhere from 5 to 15 people. Similarly to at Camp Last Hope, you know, they've had access to medicine, food, donations, as well as the bathroom in his house. And, you know, that has also caused some conflict with his neighbors who are frustrated that he's sort of, you know, bringing this into their neighborhood. There are also neighbors who think it's a good thing. They don't think that the city has done enough to address homelessness. And, you know, they say, here is someone trying to solve the problem. You know, let's let them help. And so, again, just kind of that push and pull between the official system that's set up to address homelessness and these community organizers who are creating their own ways and methods of helping people who maybe are less likely to seek the official homeless resources system.
It's an interesting action by Darren Mann, and he's taking that action because, you know, in his mind, he says he just, you know, you can't look the other way. And that, you know, we'd all wish that this wasn't a problem, but that for his part, he can't ignore it. And so he's also trying to put pressure on elected officials with this. Is that correct? I mean, he's trying to sort of call attention to the problem by bringing it to his own home.
Yeah, and some of his neighbors have accused him of, you know, just seeking publicity. And his response to that is kind of, you know, that's exactly what I'm doing. I want people to recognize this is a problem. And, you know, a lot of people just complain about homelessness, but they're not really doing anything to help address it. And so he's hoping he can draw a little bit more attention to this issue and, you know, help city leaders. He's another one who would like to work and reform the system. Both him and the organizers at Camp Last Hope are sort of pushing this idea that the city should use some of the excess land that it has or excess buildings that it has to help shelter people and get people off of the streets. And so, you know, they have some of their own ideas about what would work.
Right.
And this is sort of how he's trying to call attention to that.
One of those is sort of tiny home communities, as if I remember from your reporting. What about the Salt Lake City, you know, what about the city administration and the ordinance, you know, are there not ordinances at, you know, in place that might prevent someone from having people camp on their property for too long?
Yeah, definitely. And that was something for me I really had to do some digging to try and find out, because so often we see property owners who don't want an encampment there, but having a property owner who has invited them there, you know, is that a private property right for you to be able to do that? And it turns out it's not. So there are county health department regulations preventing someone from having encampments for up to 10 consecutive days is what they're allowed to do. And after that, they'll have to go through and get exemptions. There's also a separate rule that just forbids the establishment of camps altogether in order to mitigate environmental and public health hazards. The last time I talked to Darren, he was working with city and county officials, you know, code enforcement, to try and work something out. He would like to see them stay at least until things get a little bit warmer, because many people who camp are moving around the city a lot, getting pushed from one place to another. And organizers say that's not good for people, you know, their mental health, their well-being, to be able to focus on jobs and sort of lifting themselves out of homelessness. And if they can have some stability, then they can sort of, you know, get their lives moving in a different direction. And so he wants to see them have that stability, stay at his home, and at least until, you know, the days start to get a little bit warmer.
News columnist Robert Gierke, part of this is, yeah, is exactly what Taylor just said, the helping people through the winter months. But then, I don't know, I guess maybe I'd ask for your comments on the sort of larger societal problem. I mean, there are some advanced democracies out there in the world who don't face this problem to the extent that we do. I don't know. I mean, do you want to go that sort of macro level, or do you want to focus on these specific actions?
Well, I mean, I think what everybody understands or is beginning to understand is the complexity of the problem that we're facing, right? I mean, there are so many factors at play, and you can't force people to go to shelters. I mean, I think ideally people would go to shelters where they can not only get, you know, a roof, a bed, a meal, but also kind of get some of the services that are provided there, whether it be, you know, mental health, addiction services, and get into potentially on a track for long-term permanent housing. And so, you know, that's the ideal situation. But, you know, as we all know, life isn't ideal. And so, you know, there are people who don't want to go to the shelters, and you know, in which case, where do they go? It's a complicated, complicated issue, and I think a lot of people are working in good faith to try to resolve it, but you don't really ever resolve all of it, so you're trying to alleviate as much of it as you can with the competing interests that are at play between, you know, property owners, business owners, you know, people that want to put people in their front yards versus people who want, you know, want their businesses to be, you know, don't want people in front, loitering in front of the businesses, for example. And so, yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly complicated situation, and I think Taylor's done a terrific job in highlighting some of the dynamics that we're dealing with here. And I don't have a good answer. I mean, right. I think it's a process that we're working through, and we'll continue to work through for, you know, as long as we're here, most likely.
And Taylor Stevens, just to wrap up this story, you may have already answered this, but you mentioned the fact that there are some ordinances in place. I guess I wonder, is the city going to take action when it comes to people staying on Darren Mann's property?
The city code enforcement has been in touch with Darren, and he was trying, as I said, trying to work with them, see if they could come to some temporary solution. And so I think we'll have to kind of stay tuned and see what happens with that, whether those discussions go anywhere or whether the city decides that this is, you know, a burden on the neighborhood and causing, you know, health problems, and they want it gone. We'll have to see what happens with that.
Okay. Thank you, Taylor Stevens, for your reporting on this. We have very limited time to turn to any other coverage, but I will bring reporter Courtney Tanner back into the show to ask you, Courtney, about a story. I mean, there were a couple of stories that you covered that I invited you to cover on the show. And let's turn to the fact that the first ever chief safety officer at the University of Utah, who was brought in to sort of reform the police department there, he, after a year in the post, is stepping down. Why is he doing that?
Yeah, Marlon Lynch is, he's accepted a new job overseeing public safety at Michigan State University, which is his alma mater.
And remind us exactly what the sort of circumstances of his being brought in. This was a new position, correct?
Yeah, so this is kind of the inaugural person in this position, and it was created in the wake of athlete Lauren McCluskey's murder, you know, which obviously raised concerns about the campus police department and how they were handling cases, specifically like with female victims. And so Marlon Lynch was brought in to kind of help rebuild that, rebuild trust, and he was put in this position as chief safety officer to, you know, oversee that, but also other security operations on campus.
And how did that go, that effort to sort of reform, to change the nature of the University of Utah Police Department?
Yeah, it probably depends on who you ask, but the university has said that they are proud of the work that Marlon Lynch has done. You know, they point to him kind of restructuring the department and forming these committees that involve student voices, you know, with police policy. So I would say that, you know, within a year, he did accomplish quite a bit.
The other part of the story that I wanted to get to that relates to this is the just the sort of vast number of pieces of legislation, not vast, but the pieces of legislation that are being heard at the legislative session this year related to that on-campus murder that you talked about of Lauren McCluskey. Can you, this is tough to do in the next, you know, minute and a half that we have, Courtney, but how many pieces of legislation are we talking about? What's the sort of general ambit of the bills that want to change things in the wake of the of that campus murder?
Right. So there's one bill that will be the settlement agreement that Lauren McCluskey's family has agreed to end their case against the University of Utah. And then apart from that, there are seven bills, and they largely look to kind of fix the police misconduct problems that happened with Lauren McCluskey's case. So the officer that was assigned to her case, it's been confirmed by the State Department of Public Safety, had actually shared photos that she sent in with her concerns of extortion. He shared those photos with some coworkers for non-work-related reasons.
Okay. Again, I will point people to Courtney Tanner's reporting on this at shealthtrip.com. And Courtney, we didn't get to more of your reporting, and I'm sorry that I didn't save time for that. But as a way of offering an olive branch, how about I give you the first bite at the underplayed story of the week, our final segment of the show? What would you like to go with?
Yeah, we have two Report for America reporters at the Tribune, and they did a really interesting look on domestic violence funding and kind of the concern that that's going to wane in this coming year, and that those folks may not be able to help as many victims as they've been helping, and it's increased during the pandemic.
Okay, the Report for America reporting at sltrib.com, worth checking out. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story of the week, if you're ready.
Yeah, my colleague Andy Larson, who has been our COVID data guru, has a modeling today on when we might hit herd immunity in Utah based on the current vaccine numbers that we're hearing. He's got a pessimistic model, an optimistic model, and kind of a mid-range, and they're all worth checking out if you're looking for some hope on your Friday.
Yeah, and well, we're all anxious to know when any individual in any group might get the vaccine. Thanks for that pick, Robert Gerke. We've got a little bit more time than I expected. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Okay, Taylor took mine, so I'm gonna call it audible here. Everybody should look at that explainer that Andy did. I think it's really useful. I'm fascinated by this ongoing saga of Patrick Byrne. The former, CEO of Overstock, who found himself sort of by serendipity in the Oval Office in a fairly contentious meeting over whether the president should continue to fight the election results. Right. And now he has been named in a lawsuit by the Dominion, the maker of the Smartmatic, I guess is its name now, the maker of the voting machines for defamation. He's been named as they've asked social media companies to retain documents relating to him because he's, peddled these conspiracy theories that the election was stolen, the machines were rigged, and so on and so forth. It's just fascinating. And when you look at Patrick's history with the Russian spy and all of these things, it's quite a yarn. And so, check out. There's a couple stories at sltrip.com related to Patrick and these episodes involving the election and the president.
I forgot about the Russian spy part of the story, but the most recent one that caught my attention was the fact that he basically talked his way into the Oval Office on for that meeting that you described taking place.
Yeah, there was a scene there where the White House counsel said, "Who the heck are you?" Yeah. And so he was just kind of, by chance ended up there.
Well, Robert Gerke, thanks for that pick or those picks for underplayed story of the week. I'm just going to mention that we had a couple of people who called in to comment on HB 60, the concealed carry bill. That is a story we will definitely get to. In fact, we'll try to get to it next week. We've covered it before, and it has not, I don't think, gotten its final hearing, so there's more to come. For my part, again, underplayed story of the week, this is not yet a done deal, but seems like almost a kind of a foregone conclusion. Tribune Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley reported on a bill heard in committee yesterday, a bill sponsored by the House Speaker and the Senate President which means that it's a bill that both will be prioritizing. And I'm just going to read from Mafley's article. Without any prior public involvement or notice, lawmakers assembled legislation to create a six-member entity called the Colorado River Authority of Utah, charged with implementing a management plan to ensure that Utah can protect and develop the Colorado River system. Mafley's reporting goes on to say that the bill creates an entity. There's $9 million to fund it and includes provisions to keep its meetings secret. And ostensibly, that's to allow the six-member commission to strategize as they go toe-to-toe with other states over the dwindling supply of the Colorado River. However, environmentalists say that the more likely reason to them is that the secrecy is to avoid scrutiny as they fund the Lake Powell pipeline. There is some impassioned testimony in that committee. You can check out Brian Mafley's reporting on that and everything else that we have been covering at sltrib.com. And I will say, Courtney Tanner, Taylor Stevens, Robert Gerke, all with that newspaper, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
You too. Have a great weekend. That does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts of this show at kcpw.org or through whatever app you use to listen. We are an entirely independent local public radio resource. Find out more at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. Join us again next week. We had some audio issues during the show today. We're going to try and get those resolved.